You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hi, this is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to my podcast, You Can't Say That. It's the podcast where you can, on the Broadway Podcast Network. There is nothing I love more than talent. Oh, it just thrills me. It gets me high. It just is like electricity in my body. And I experienced that last night when I saw the new West Side Story in its first preview on Broadway. And that's the same way I feel about my next guest. I got to see 12 hours of his 24-hour musical project. Please join me in welcoming the inimitable Taylor Mack. So this is Tanya Pinkins, and it's the You Can't Say That podcast, the show where you can, on the Broadway Podcast Network. And as happens when you're in a beautiful space looking out at the New York skyline and my guests come in, we get to talking. So I'm already in the midst of a great conversation with my wonderful guest today, artist, performance artist, playwright, singer, songwriter, director, choreographer, Taylor Mack. So let's
maybe
just pick back up with The Gift. We were talking about this book, The Gift. Tell me about it. I feel like I read it a long time ago, but what is it?
I forget who wrote it, but it's about the gift exchange economy as opposed to the commodities exchange commodity and how we're living in this commodities exchange commodity. And I would say that he used an example in one part of the book about underoos. Remember underoos and the little toys in Burger King. The Burger King started And what they were doing is they were commodifying the bond between the parent and the child. So they did a study. They realized that that children are usually the person who decides when the parent is tired after coming home from work, what where they were going to eat, where the family is going to eat. And so if they could get to the child, then the child will say Burger King. And so then that, so they put these toys, they said it, they presented it like a, you know, it's basically a, they presented it like just a gift or something like that, but it actually is
it's kind of a little addiction, right? Hey, we get your kid wants to come back to get the next gift, and now we got you come in here because your kid is actually dictating this choice,
right? And so what they're doing is that and they put the underoos, they sold them in the supermarket because that was what the study said, that that's the time when the child is with the mother the most. Is they're not, they don't normally go to the department store or something with them, but they will go to the supermarket. So they put the underoos in the supermarket so the kid could say, I want that. So the whole exchange, the bond between the mother and the child, is turned into a commodity for them. It's just the, I mean, it's the most horrible thing ever. But it's a wonderful book because it really frames how what the alternatives could be, and how we can live in a gift exchange economy if we set our minds to it.
Well, that also is about like the different websites you can go to where there's just this exchange of things, like free stuff, and people are giving away things, and you can, if you go pick them up, you can get cars, you can get all kinds of things that people, furniture, whatever, where people are like, we're not selling, we are offering things, and there's this way we're preventing litter, etc., by just exchanging things with other people who have the need of the thing we no longer desire.
And you know, Jackson, Mississippi is the lead in that right now.
Really?
Yeah, there's all these activists that are down there really changing that. I forget what
collaborative consumption.
Collaborative, yes, but it's like it's basically a bunch of co-ops that are, you know, exchanging amongst each other, and I don't really know the details of it, so I'm curious to find out. So if you see me on the street, please tell me about it if you know.
Yeah, the other piece that, you know, this thing about what they're doing with the kids brought up for me is, I don't know if you ever heard of this woman, Charlotte Isserby. Charlotte Isserby, she may not even be alive anymore, but she was the head of the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan. And that was when they were thinking of getting rid of the Department of Education. And so she had this time.
What a wonderful idea.
Yes. Well, they're going to do
Let's get rid of education.
They're going to do it. And it, you know, it was black people who said we need compulsory education. So they're like, well, how can we? She spent her time trying to figure out what was the purpose of the Department of Education in the first place. Yeah. And what she discovered in looking through the documents in this building that she was now in control of was that the purpose of the Department of Education was to create compliant citizens. And they first thought that that could
happen
with...
That's what she felt.
No, that's what the documentation said. That they were following a Prussian system, and that the first thing they thought would create compliant citizens was war. And so then World War I happened, and they killed all these people, and there was all this trauma. And they're like, oh, well, that doesn't work.
But they tried it again.
They tried. No, so then they said, well, what they realized was some people wouldn't be compliant citizens. So they had to figure out who those people were. I think you and I would probably fall into that
list. I think so.
And that they had to find out who those people were, and then they had to track them out of the system. So whether that was into the military or into jail or whatever. And she said that was the beginning of no reading, writing, and arithmetic, but just other courses with fancy names. And she said she realized that she was one of those people who wouldn't ever be a compliant citizen. So she said then they went a little further, and they realized, well, that wasn't enough or fast enough. And they realized that you couldn't have a compliant citizen if they had an authority other than the government. So that began this period of breaking the parent-child bond.
Charter schools.
Well, breaking the parent-child authority bond and defreezing values. Because if there was absolute rights and wrongs, then the government didn't have the ability to say, no, this is right and this is wrong. Even, you know, your parents can't tell you that. The government sets it, and they set it as they please. And she said that moved into this idea that you can only create a compliant citizen if you can control the neurology. And that was this move that we're in right now, which is towards bookless education, because they realize that with a real book, you're engaging and your brain is active, but anything on a screen, it's passive reception.
Yeah.
So you could get people to engage with the surface, be it a game or a questionnaire, and you could passively be sending them anything you wanted.
Yeah.
And that's what it made me think about Burger King, you know, because the surveillance capitalism is about how this thing moved from online into the world where they're constantly collecting our data, tracking our gestures, everything we're doing, and predicting what we're going to do. Like, they've hacked us.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm feeling they have hacked us. And we're sitting here in this amazing apartment looking at a smidgen of the New York skyline because the buildings are so big around us. And I'm thinking that, I forget where I read this, but it is... The saying goes that you can tell what a society is ruled by what the tallest building is.
Really?
So it used to be the church, the cathedrals were the tallest building, right? And then it used to be the castles, and then it was the cathedrals, and now today it's for a while, yeah. So it used to be the government building, then it was the church, and now of course it's the corporate building. So our entire lives are run by these giant buildings around us right now.
Yeah, that is that they have more money than governments have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
And we got some construction going on.
We have nonstop construction going on. And that's.
But I heard that the New York real estate market has collapsed.
Oh, yeah, except for they're still making all their money. I mean, it's not collapsed. I mean, look at it. The people, there's more construction happening right now than there ever has been. And that's the thing that I find. Oh, God, we're going at it now. But that's the thing I find so fascinating about the current race for the presidency and the current conversation is especially regarding Elizabeth Warren and the economy. And she wants to tax people at a lower rate, rich people at a lower rate.
Elizabeth Warren does?
Yeah, she wants to tax them at a lower rate than we taxed rich people in the 70s. And they're saying that it's some radical thing. They're framing her like a radical. And I think she just wants us to be reasonable. It's so interesting to me,
right,
that the language of hyperbole as activism, you know, I mean, hyperbole is activism. It's agenda, you know, so.
Well, have you looked at this book, Winners Take All? Mm-mm. That is a whole book about how the elite have now taken social justice and they use it as PR.
Yes.
So they do some good for a community, and now they right. have control over the social justice movement, and they decide who are the yeah. leaders, and then they make it work to make sure
justice.
That they are still kept in power. You know, we have all these philanthropic yeah. companies and organizations, and yet we've seen the greatest wealth transfer since the French Revolution,
yeah.
you know, has happened in our lifetime. And yeah. that interests me because you were talking on an interview that I listened to about this idea that during the AIDS epidemic, the conservative gay people were made spokespersons, and that sort of changed the agenda yeah. of what people who were suffering
yeah,
were
I
actually
got that
going
from,
through.
Sarah Shulman book called Gentrification of the Mind, which it made absolute sense when I read it, which her theory is that all the radical, imaginative, creative leader thinkers either died of AIDS or were so traumatized by all their friends dying of AIDS that they had to take a step back and heal. And so there was this opening for leadership. And so the new leaders were assigned by heterosexuals, and they were chosen, they were people who the heterosexuals felt comfortable with. So, and agendas that the heterosexuals felt comfortable with. So they chose people who were going to really advocate for gay marriage and gays in the military, which was never something that are the queer leaders that kind of came up from the ground up who were interested in, you know. It was not something that any of the community was talking about before, and suddenly it was the most important thing, and that was a result of AIDS.
That's fascinating, because it feels akin to the fact that in Native American cultures, you speak your opinion. Not speaking is as powerful a statement as speaking. And so the people that the Americas made treaties with were the people who came and spoke, who were this small minority of people when the majority of Native people did not speak, which was their no, we don't want a treaty with you. And so we have this history of relations and agreements with a group of people who have a different understanding of what language means, and we just ignored their language.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Yeah, there's a part in 24 Decade that we do where this Native American Two Spirits person is going to a missionary school for the first time, and she uses the pronoun she. she thinks that to be respectful, you sit and you listen, and you consider. And you wonder for a very long time before you answer. And the teacher interprets that as slow. And so she's labeled, you know, unintelligent instead of actually somebody who considers, you know, because they're, right? So that's the thing I'm trying to do. And it's funny to say that on a podcast where I'm asked about to talk. But I'm trying to just take my time to consider things more, and not just, you know, I feel like there's this plague of opinions in the world, and I'm just, how can I just be a little bit more Socratic method about things, just ask more questions and just wonder for a long time.
Yeah, and that reminds me of the fact that, you know, when they actually did a deeper sort of analysis of why our Asians supposedly better at math than Americans, what they found was that Americans spend about 10 minutes and then they can't figure it out and they move on. And Asians are like, they just sit with it until something clicks. And that might be 45 minutes. They're not in a hurry and they're not deciding that it didn't come to me quickly, so I can't do it. They're like, okay, well, let me just wrestle with this for a lot longer time than an American is willing to wrestle with something they don't get.
We like to fake it till we make it.
Yeah, and we sell it to the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, what are we going to do?
Well, I am actually sort of very positive about it because I do think that there is an evolutionary force inside of everything that is always moving towards higher levels of order. Even what looks like destruction to us is some other creation coming forward. I just believe that. So it keeps me sane, you know, looking to see what is birthing out of this, you know, a lightning storm or the decay of a tree. It's now nurturing a whole forest of new trees that are going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a huge fire up in our, I have a country place because I'm fancy now, and we had a huge fire and almost burned the house down and burned down, I mean, about 100 trees. But within a year, I mean, you still see the charcoal dead trees are up everywhere and everything. But within a year, it's you're seeing new life come to it. So it does give you hope, and change is a good thing and all that stuff. But also the tragedy is real. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's, to me, what truth is to me, is that it can hold polarities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the tragedy is real. And the new birth is real too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're both real and they are both the truth.
Well, and since tragedy is inevitable, we might as well try to figure out what to do with it, right? That's the only way to live. Like, how do you live a virtuous life in an unvirtuous world, right? Is the question I just continually ask over and over. Since I did that play, A Good Person of Sichuan, which that's the main question of the play, is how do you live a virtuous life in an unvirtuous world? And I just keep going back to that. You know, someone asked me recently about the GOP and Trump and saying, well, don't we have to listen to their side of things, and don't we have to see, and aren't you just as bad as they are if you don't listen? I said, no, because they lie. So they know they are lying. We know they're lying. They know we know they're lying. So it's not an actual debate. It's not an actual conversation. It's somebody listening to and trying to engage in with lies. So that is an unvirtuous world. What we have to do is try to figure out how to live virtuously within that unvirtuous world. And what's fascinating about the hearings is to see how everyone's trying to do it. You know, some people are placating. Some people are trying to get every detail, all the information. Some people go to their superiors and try to get their superiors to deal with it. You know, everyone's navigating how to live in this crazy, unvirtuous world. it's super fascinating to me.
I'm going to ask Beatrice, are we going to have to redo this whole thing? Like,
no, I think we're going to be able to just, like, because the volume of the mics are low enough,
okay. I just don't want to like have sat here and talked to you for an hour and they're like, oh yeah, we couldn't do any of that. I think,
but the mer sound is the unvirtuous world coming in.
Well, I feel like that's what the appeal of The Walking Dead is. Mm. Like in this area where the anti-hero is in most of the shows, like, you know, we like all these characters who are just crooked and rotten.
Yeah.
And in The Walking Dead, it's a world where zombies are forever. When you die, you become one. And yet people are trying to figure out how to live, how to raise their children, how to be good people when zombies are forever. I mean, to me, that is the appeal of the zombie world for me.
It
is,
I love
the zombies are
metaphor
for anything bad in anybody's world.
Yeah. I'm a big zombie fan.
I'm a big zombie fan. Did you know I was a zombie on Fear of the Walking Dead?
I did know that, actually. I forgot it. But
I was Martha the Filthy Woman.
I've seen every episode.
Oh, yeah. I loved it.
They bore me. If I'm totally honest, at this point, I'm like, okay, now it feels
they're not coming into
a soap opera. But
I'm like, when are they going to come back to the talking zombies? There were talking zombies in like the original zombie movies, and nobody's doing talking zombies again.
They tried. They tried this season, I think, or last season or something.
Those weren't real zombies. Those were people dressed in zombie clothes.
Zombies. They were trying to do like talk. They thought it would be cheesy to have them actually talk, so they made us
Return of the Living Dead, the zombies killed the ambulance people and they're like, send more paramedics. Or people were like, they like put these hooks in this zombie and they're like, why do you try to eat our brains? And she was like, the pain of being dead. You can feel being dead. Yes, and brains leave the pain of being dead, you know.
Did you had fun being on that show?
It was the most exciting thing I've ever done on television.
Really?
I dreamed of it. I told my agents when I met them, anything zombie, I want to be on it. And when I got it, it was like, yes, this is what I want to do. It was the first time on television that I got to be the, quote, star for a moment, for a day, because I was the villain. And so I got to be a villain. And it was like, oh, this is what this like. I like this. Now I've experienced that. I can move on and try to do something else in my life.
Isn't that interesting? That I find that fascinating, that thing where like you have this obsession, you want to do this thing. And sometimes I go, the thing that I wanted when I was 14 is not necessarily what I want now. But the obsession is there and you can't let it go until you do it.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating.
You got to have that thing that you want, you know? Yeah, it's like when I want a specific thing to eat, nothing is going to satisfy that itch until it's that thing.
That thing.
Yeah, and then you realize,
I don't want that.
Well, you did want it and you had it and you found out, okay, that was enough.
Yeah.
You know, moving on to the next thing now.
Yeah. That's how I felt about Broadway.
Me too. I always tell people, I know you think Broadway is to be all in and all, but there are some other things.
There's some other things, but you got to go
find that out for yourself.
I know. There's a wonderful world out there of performance. There's thrilling stuff, and they don't even make you work as hard.
Well, you brought us to Broadway, so you know. I know some things about your show, Gary, and I want to talk about them because most people don't even know about them.
I know, but I don't know if I feel comfortable talking. Well, we could talk
We talk about it, and if you find that it isn't, we'll cut it out. If we talk about something and you're like, oh, no, we can't say that. But, you know, I saw Gary and I saw it in previews, and you had shared with me and George shared with me that there was supposed to be a moment of a live black baby at the end of the play that most people never got to see. I think one audience got to see it.
One audience, yeah.
So tell us about the impulse of that.
Well, I wanted there to be a moment at the end of the play where the end of the play is different every night, dictated by something that can't be controlled.
Yes.
You know? And I wanted that to be a black baby. because in Titus Andronicus there's a black baby, and I wanted all the characters have to cede their control to something, and the audience to something that might scare them, that might make them nervous for the baby, that made them question the ethics of even having a baby on stage, that wasn't there to make them feel sentimental necessarily. Maybe it might one night, it might be cute and everyone goes, aww, you know, okay, that's how that night ended. But I wanted the show to end differently every single night. And the circumstances of our rehearsal process was such that we basically were in panic mode from the start. And there was just, it wasn't prioritized to rehearse with the baby. And so then the baby got thrown in on the last minute and people didn't feel comfortable and didn't know how to handle the improv of that moment and the delicacy and the responsibility of holding a baby. It would be scary, I would think. The irony, though, is that there was another baby in the same season in that Irish play.
Yes.
You know, a cute little white baby that always... performed cute, you know, and the whole audience went aww every single night, which was just to me cloying, but manipulative, and I guess I wanted a moment of that we can't control. You know, that we can frame, but we can't control.
Mm-hmm. Is that, like, that excites me. And so it sounds like you're saying, I mean, and maybe it's really just that Broadway wasn't ready to have that because it is such a commercial model and it is kind of a standardization. And
I question that. But yeah, I think the circumstances of our rehearsal process was just never going to allow it to be easy.
Will you do it somewhere again? Because I think it's an exciting thing to bring to an audience, to make them have to actively engage. I will say that I saw that play. What was it called?
The Irish play. The Irish one.
I can't remember, but I liked it.
The Ferryman.
And I was not in awe of them. I was like, there's a baby at the edge of the stage. Where the baby rolls over. What is going on? There's a baby.
Oh, so you were concerned.
I was like, there's a baby on the edge of the friggin' stage.
I did like that she walked down those steps, those giant steps holding that baby. I was like, ooh, that's dangerous. Okay, all right then, you know.
Yeah. But it wasn't a ooh moment for me. It was like, okay, what's going to happen?
Yeah,
for me, it was like, what's going to happen? And what I loved about that play is we had our bunny rabbit. We had a real, a swamp, a goose.
I know.
We had a fire. Like, that's what I loved about that play. It was like, yeah, this is some real stuff is happening here.
They brought the real stuff in there. Yeah. To me, it was just framed a little bit too much. Or controlled a little too much. I don't know. Maybe your night the baby cried. Did the baby cry?
I saw it a couple times, and the baby did not ever cry when I was there.
Yeah, they trained that baby.
Do you train a baby?
They did some techniques. They did some techniques to get the baby comfortable in front of an audience and to da 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 da, you know. And
you all didn't have time to train your baby.
I didn't want us to train the baby. I wanted us to train the actors how to deal with the baby.
That little baby from the Ferryman and put some blackface on it.
Oh, Jesus.
Could have been like Cynthia Nixon going from one theater to the other.
Yeah, we should have just...
Because your play was that a short been play, and then he could have gone back and done his little part in acting.
If we had done that, we'd still be running. But anyway, it's in the script, so hopefully people will do it, you know. I mean, you know how it is on Broadway. People do things on Broadway, and then that sets the precedent, and then you've got to fight the way that your play has been rewritten by people that aren't you for the rest of the play's existence.
You know, Cheryl West told me her play, Jar of the Floor, people kept wanting to bring it to New York, not even to Broadway, and she was like, this play is paying my mortgage. Just playing the Regents for 5 years, it is paying my mortgage. I do not wish to, you know, affect my livelihood by somebody in New York saying something bad about it. And now, it's been said. Now we don't want to do your play anymore.
Yeah.
This play that's doing so well. And it's an unfortunate thing.
It's interesting. Yeah, my play here has had, I think, 72 productions now around the world. And I have made way more money off of that than I did working on Broadway. But even before it had all those productions, I made more money off of that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess having an off-Broadway play at Playwrights Horizons is more lucrative than Broadway. Because on Broadway, everybody wants a piece of the pie. So you got to give this percentage and this percentage and this percentage. Even the Guild wants you to give them a percentage you're on Broadway. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And they all take it from the playwright's salary, not the producer's salary, from the playwright's salary. It's amazing. It really is amazing.
And someone was telling me recently about, like, and sometimes on Broadway, the playwright has to give a percentage to the directors, too?
George and George Wolfe and who's the other one?
Joe Mantello.
Yeah, Joe Mantello are the two that demand that, you know, okay. and they justify it by saying that they're really working as dramaturgical directors, so it's their, I guess it's their dramaturgy fee, but I wouldn't choose to do that again because I made so little, you know. I worked for a year and had to say no to everything. I mean, luckily I got a fancy grant, so I'm fine, but I had to say no to everything while I was working on that, and contractually, you know, I couldn't work in New York City other than that. And then I had to I had to cut my salary even and all my royalties and everything. So it was definitely, it was a learning
The school of hard knocks.
Learning experience.
It's an expensive,
the school of bourgeois hard knocks.
You know, I think that people are so, I think sometimes I feel like we want the romance of things and that we aren't even interested in the reality of it. It's like the fact that people think you're on Broadway. It's fabulous. It's wonderful. And it's like they don't care about the reality that you could make a lot of money in the regions and around the world. Like, but you're on Broadway.
Yeah.
Isn't enough. Or like, I'm on Broadway, but we lost all the money. But you were on Broadway.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And,
well, and that's the like here has a role for a trans man or a genderqueer actor. And so it's been done 72 times by 72 different trans men or genderqueer actors have played the role. And a vast majority of them have never had access to their professional theater in their town. Mm. So that's not the kind of thing. If it had been on Broadway and been a huge hit, then maybe that would have happened all around the world. But that's that happened, you know. That happened. And so I don't know. I think that's... I didn't intend for that to happen. I didn't set out for that to happen. But it's this beautiful result of writing this play and Playwrights Horizons doing it and everybody then wanting, you know, that weird thing that happens where somebody in New York does a play and then everybody wants to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and you don't have control over that. Like, it's just... was the moment. It was supposed to be a synchronicity about that.
Yeah, it's sweet. So that's just to say that really good things can happen from both Broadway and off-Broadway. But Broadway is not the only thing. Nobody knows about the presenting world. In the actor world, in the New York theater world, very few people are aware of the presenting world.
What's the presenting world?
So BAM is a presenting house for the most part. I think they're getting into producing now, but... so there are all these festivals all around the world, and they're doing all the incredible work. It's where Robert Wilson and Lucinda Childs and Philip Glass and all of them, you know, would work. And it's where I work primarily. It's just touring the world, playing these gorgeous theaters, performing in the presenting world, and you do a couple shows a week and.
But do you have to fund that yourself, or are the presenters providing the finances to bring you there and put your show up?
It depends on the festival or the presenter. So with something like 24 Decade, I work with a production company called Pomegranate Arts, and they did Einstein on the Beach, and they're just wonderful. They're family, and they. So they produce, and then the presenter. We were just at the Berliner Festspiele in Berlin, and the Berliner Festspiele kind of joined with them because 24 Decade is so huge to make that all happen. So it's kind of a co-production. I mean, we produce the show, we make the show, and then they kind of are responsible for housing and the Berliner Festspiele for housing and paying salaries and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes they just give you a big blanket fee and then you have to figure out how to divide it up. And sometimes they provide more than that, you know. So something like the Under the Radar Festival at the Public is working under a presenting model. You know, and there's pros and cons to it because you kind of have to make it yourself and you don't. A lot of people don't have a lot of support, don't have producers to help them do that. But if you have a producer or you are a producer and you make it, it gives you more power over the art. You don't have to put up with bullshit?
You can.
You don't have to put up with a smidgen of the bullshit that you have to put up with when you're working in neoliberal American theater. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that With brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Yeah, no, that's real. So I know I'm a friend of Kate Riggs. And Kate told me that actually Gary was written for her and Christine and you to do.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it wasn't written for Kate, but it was. But I cast her in the first reading, and I love her, and I think she's a wonderful.
But that you
actor.
Intended that to be an of color person, and that you were going to play Gary.
I was supposed to play Gary. I wrote Gary for myself. I wrote Janice for Christine, and I wasn't sure what I was really doing with Carol. You know, I was experimenting with Carol, and I was trying to figure it out. I didn't know. Part of the character is the fragility of white guilt. So I wasn't sure if casting a person of color would change that narrative to a degree that I didn't like. You know, or if I needed to let go of that narrative just so that I didn't have a all white cast, which I don't like.
I have the building manager here to figure out where the noise is coming from.
She's like contacted the building manager.
Amazing.
I like these pants. May I touch them?
Yes, please.
It's not like me touching your hair, but I wanted to know what the fabric was.
You cut your hair.
I did. Yeah, I'd after playing that zombie because I was hey.
From the wall, so my desk is
like, someone drilling right above us?
Above.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, if you want to, stay here until you hear it.
Yeah, just so I can get a sense of it.
Yeah, we'll continue.
Okay. Thank you.
They might be done.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
I don't know. Yeah.
They were going at it, though. They were going at it. Should we keep going?
Yeah.
Oh. So what, you know, I understand the Broadway things, but I want to understand it from you, the artist's point of view. I mean, at the point that Gary was going to Broadway, you're a MacArthur genius. You've won awards all over the decision to not have you in the lead. You're a force in and of itself.
Well, yeah. You know, it was presented to me that the producer didn't feel that this was the kind of play that would succeed without stars.
Without a star person, which is this new thing. You've got to be a TV star or a movie star or something in order to sell tickets on Broadway kind of thing. This new model we have.
And that's it's not invalid.
Okay.
That
for a play
consideration. For a brand new play that's a little tricky. You know, a little, I don't think it's that untraditional because it seems to me very Greek, you know.
Right.
I was like, this is just Aristophanes, you know, combining verse and lowbrow humor and highbrow humor and squishing them in the same play is Elizabethan, is every, you
agreed.
Know, is like everything that we say is theater is supposed to be. So,
agreed.
So I don't, I didn't see it tricky that way, But Rudin felt that it was a tricky one and that it would need a star. And so I made the choice. It was my choice. You know, I could have said, no, I'm going to do this at the Hero Arts Center where I was originally going to do it, or play the lead. And I thought, you know, these opportunities don't come around every day, and I've never done this thing before, and I wrote this play, and I can do it again in the future. I'm not going to age out of the part. And so I said, why not? And, you know, I'm a talent whore, so I love a talented person. And when Nathan Lane was suggested, I think he's, you know, extraordinarily talented, and I like learning from watching as well. So I just thought, well, why not do this? Why not have Nathan Lane play it? And I also remember Terrence McNally one time saying, when they made the movie of The Rink, he demanded that it be all people that, you know, had been in the play on Broadway and stuff. And they were like, no, we want it to be, you know, Barbra Streisand and this person and that person. And
he was like, no, it must be the original people, you know. And that was great of him. And at the same time, he was expressing a little regret. He was like, it would have been fabulous to have Barbara Streisand in my movie, you know. So, you know, there was this, that part of my voice was going, well, why don't you just see? I know what it's like to work with me, but I don't know what it's like to work with Nathan Lane and to see that happen. So it was a fascinating experience. I definitely... don't want to, I mean, so this is the thing I learned on Broadway. Off Broadway is basically the same. So I was told that they didn't want to produce the play without a star on Broadway. And then off Broadway, I was told they couldn't produce it with me because I'm equity. a different play of mine, and they were a non-equity company. And so both experiences, I was told I can't be in the play that for the part that I wrote for myself if wow. they're going to do it. You know, and it's my choice to either go down that road with them or to not. And in both cases, I've chosen to go down the road, right. You know. So yeah. That's, I don't have any... resentment for that, but I did have a little bit of jealousy when I saw my friend Heidi Schreck, you know, go from off Broadway to off Broadway to Broadway with her entire company for What the Constitution Means to Me and have a great success. There was this part of me that was like, oh, I wish people would just have, I wish I would have just demanded people take a chance on me. You know, I did have that regret, but, and I'm blabbing because I had coffee, but I also don't think Gary was the kind of play that would have transferred. You know, I think it would have had its run off Broadway, maybe transferred to off Broadway, but it wouldn't have transferred to the any more than that. And because I'm not telling stories that are supporting the status quo. And that's like,
well, there's
was
that.
The only play on Broadway that wasn't centered around a status quo.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
there's that.
Yeah.
There's that winners take all, like, you know. Yeah, I mean, I love Hamilton. I've seen it 13 times.
But, I know. It's wonderful.
Hamilton preceded the movie Get Out, but in hindsight, I'm like, it's Get Out.
It's Get Out.
Like white people inhabiting black people's bodies.
It's Get Out.
And I was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
I love it, but it is Get Out.
I know. And that's how they trick you. That's how they get you. They give you some amazing songs and amazing lyrics and incredible polish. You know,
an amazing talent.
It's the most polished piece of Broadway I've ever seen.
I think
it's remarkable.
Remarkable. I love it. But
and it's about how great capitalism is.
And how great white people are. The white people who were slaveholders who founded our country.
I mean, that's one of the stories.
No, there's a lot of stories. But, you know, like in the mixtape, you got the song that, you know, didn't make it to Broadway or even to off-Broadway about, you know, what they were going to do with the slaves, which the plan was at first to send them all back to Africa. And then Frederick Douglass was like, no, we are as American as anybody is American. And he believed that if we fought in the war, then that would make our claim to citizenship. It did not. It just meant that there would be generations of brown people who would be cannon fodder. Yeah. But Frederick Douglass really believed that, you know, if we fight for this land, then that secures our claim for citizenship, because being born here certainly did not.
Yeah. Freaking Frederick Douglass. So that was in the original show, and they cut it for
There's a whole song reason. About this argument about, you know, what are we going to do about the slaves? What are we going to do about the slaves? And they're basically agreement to postpone thinking about that for some time. It's a great little it's like one of those those congressional congresses where they're having the arguments. It's one of those kind of
putting numbers. That argument in brown bodies makes it performance art. not a musical on Broadway, right? Right. Then it becomes where the deconstruction
right.
of it suddenly.
Yeah.
What's happening? You know. So they had to cut that.
Well, yeah. You might be right about that.
I don't know.
But you can get it on the mixtape.
I wasn't a fly on the wall, so I don't know why they did things, but yeah.
And there are people who are actually changing their name in order to have names of people of color in order to be in the show. I actually have, you know, I go and see it because I really love it. And I love seeing all these young people coming up and getting these opportunities. And I saw it on the road with a girl who had, you can still see her entire internet history as who she really is. But now she has a Latina last name. So so it's like, hey, you know.
Well, good.
I don't know if it's good. It's Get Out.
Well, that, yeah. Oh, is she a white woman?
Yes.
Oh, I thought she was.
No, she's a white woman gave herself a Latina name so she could be in Camelton.
No.
And you can still see the footprint online of who she really is.
Oh, no.
Yes. She's out on tour. She's wonderful, but it's like, you know, people, like, I want to be in that show. Can we have one damn show?
Well, I tell this story in 24 Decade, too, where this woman, I was in Minneapolis, and this woman, she was like, why do you have to dress like you dress? And, you know, in my drag, she saw a performance of mine, and she was drunk, and she was a board member, and she was, you know, and she said, why, you have such a good voice. You should be on Broadway. You should be in Hamilton. I was like, maybe you're saying I should play the king. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. She was, you should be. She literally said this. You should be in something. Why do you have to talk about politics? You should be in something fun like Hamilton. I was like, you do realize the whole show is about politics.
Yeah.
But she did not realize that.
No. It was just like, I got to see those singing and dancing darkies.
Well, I didn't say it. Yeah, sometimes that's what it feels like a little bit.
So are you fiending for a Broadway again?
Oh, sure. I mean, I would do it in a heartbeat.
You don't sound like, oh, yeah, I can't wait to get back.
Well, you know, it's just like, it's that thing of once you do it, you break the seal, and then you can decide if you want to do it. Exactly. You don't have that 14-year-old going, yeah, you have to do this thing. That desperation goes away. So now I have, now if somebody approaches me and they say, you want to do Broadway, but you can't be in your own show, I could be like, no, I've done that, been there. Didn't work out for me so much. Or it worked out in some ways and didn't in other ways. And so I can make that choice instead of living in that longing, you know.
I think that's a maturity issue that a lot of people don't understand, that oftentimes in the good way, when you get the thing you've longed for, whether it goes well or doesn't go well, hopefully you get the maturity that the next time it comes around, you have an option of choice rather than being led by a compulsion.
Yeah, and I suppose the there's this side of me that judges my behavior and my decisions because why do I have to learn by, why can't I, you know, make those ethical choices before, you know? And of course I do all the time, but in this particular instance, I wanted the experience, to quote Hamilton, I wanted to be in the room where it happens.
Exactly.
And then I turned out, oh, the room is not as interesting as this other room I created. I mean, the thing that I found fascinating about the Broadway experience is it was a three-character play, 90 minutes long, and 24 Decade has 200 people in it. It's 24 hours long. And we worked on it for about, well, now we're going on 10 years. And Gary was worked on for a year, you know, and there was just like an inch of drama on 24 Decade over all those years. Hardly any drama, no drama. And on Gary, a three-character play, 90 minutes, more drama than I've ever had in my entire life. And so it really tells me, oh, the room can be different. You can create a room that doesn't have all that high drama, but you have to figure it out, you know. Not that the drama is always bad, because sometimes the drama leads you to epiphany, a catharsis, you know, but you can figure out a working structure that is at least gives you your joy, you know.
two things I want to say that came up while I was listening to you. One is there's that thing that goes, experience is something you get just after you need it.
Yes, exactly.
And I have this theory about those big rooms, those big rooms. And my theory is kind of in that winners take all thing that the drama is currency in those rooms.
Huh.
And
yes, it is.
And the people who can spend the currency of that are the puppet masters, the rulers. And yeah. So the people who bring the drama, that is a sign that you can be controlled. And so you are of great value because I know what buttons to push. I know what I need to do to get you to do what I want. I know how to pacify you. Mm-hmm. But coming into those rooms with clarity and a lack of drama, that's actually kind of a frightening and a scary thing. Mm-hmm. Like if you actually walk in those rooms and you know what you want, or that is like, oh, that's difficult. Like if you're like a drug addict, we can get you some drugs, or you cry all the time, we can handle, like you scream at people. Fabulous. We know exactly how to push your buttons to get you to show up and pay and make money for us. That's my observer experience of, you know, people who are incredibly talented but bring a lot of damn drama, and I'm like, and I'm different. Tanya thinks it's difficult. I don't bring drama into the room, but you know, there's just lines you're not going to cross with me.
We're not
going to cross them. That's difficult.
Yeah,
not drama. My drama stays on the stage. It's not happening backstage.
Amazing. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you were there that night. I exploded that night that you came, and I've never done that in all of my time.
It was probably necessary.
It was necessary. I had some stuff that I was squashing down for months and months and months, and I don't like that feeling. I mean, what I learned was that that the drama is currency. That it is. That the way that some of it was working out, the process was working out, was that the bigger drama was the bigger disaster was the thing that got the attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so if in order to solve the problem that I was having, I had to create a bigger drama.
Right.
Than
no, that's
what everyone
real.
Everyone else was creating.
That is real.
And it was an ugly feeling, but it got the result.
That is real.
It was the first time, and it broke, and then things got better after that, actually. So
no,
it
that's
was
real
a lesson too. But I don't really want to have to
it's not
be
a good
a situation
feeling
like that.
And see, for me as a black woman,
right.
It's like people are always trying to push me to that, and I can't go there because then I'm a trope,
right?
You know what I'm saying? But they always trying to push me to that. They want me to cuss somebody out, and it's like, nope, I have not ever given anybody that, because then they can write me off, then they know who I am, then I'm predictable. So it's almost like a point of honor that is something you will never be able to say about me. But I think it has to do with being in this body.
Yeah.
That I don't get to do that. Because I
Robert
can
O'Hara
read you for
talks
filth.
About you get one time. For
George will tell you that. You have to have that pick that moment when you're going to have that fit.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
yes.
Well, one fit. So that's what I had. I had my one fit.
Right. But, no, you do
but,
have to have that
you
moment.
Know, as a person of color, I think you really only get one
well,
fit.
Well, I did. I had my one time. It was Mother Courage.
Did you?
But it wasn't a cussing anybody out. It was just a.
But
that was
unconscious.
About it.
I mean, I don't know what the process was like for you, but it was an unconscious concept.
To say the least.
Yeah.
To like, say the least. And it's been, you know, Brandon Jacob Jenkins and I are working on a new Mother Courage.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Because I'm a mother. Uh-huh. And so I have such a deep, first of all, I love Brecht, and I feel such a deep response
you're
to
like
that
exactly
material.
The kind of actor that should be doing Brecht.
But I disagree with pretty much everybody's interpretation of it.
Oh yeah, it was
everybody's everybody's translation. And so we're like going back to the German
boring.
And mining it and trying to figure out, like, to me the power of that text is Brecht took this thing that is so mundane to most people in the world. But every mother is living it everywhere in the world. You bring these beings into the world that you would die for. Mm. You spend your life trying to protect them, but the fact is they do not belong to you, and they can make decisions that will cost them their life. And you would do anything to keep that from happening, but ultimately it's just not in your hand. And that's every mother every day, but when you set it in a war, the stakes become really high. And I feel like nobody deals with that. Nobody deals with it. This is about children trying to individuate and a mother going, no, there's a fucking war. You can die, which is what we are also dealing with every day in the world as mothers, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. and nobody plays the play for that.
Yeah.
This relationship that every single one of us actually goes through, period. Every uh-huh. human being has to go through that relationship unless you're orphaned very early. And yeah. then you're going through it with somebody who stepped in and was that for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, I want to see it. I hope you guys finish it.
If we make it.
I hope you do.
If we make it.
This is Tanya Pinkins. Thank you for listening to part one of my interview with Taylor Mack. Part two is coming up next.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.